Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
Leaders of the World Health Organization convened yesterday for an emergency meeting on what it believed to be a significant threat to public health, the mosquito-borne Zika virus. The result of that meeting? The World Health Organization is declaring that there is an emergency surrounding the Zika virus and its transmission. The disease is often mild in adults. Some who are affected may not even feel sick, but there is currently no vaccine and no cure. And health experts suspect the rapid spread of Zika in Brazil may be tied to a sudden rash of babies born with brain abnormalities. And now some doctors are cautioning women in Latin America who may or may become pregnant to avoid any contact with mosquitoes. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Not surprisingly, poor people living in substandard housing are at greatest risk, and that means millions of our neighbors in Latin America may be vulnerable. Joining us to talk about the global implications of the Zika virus outbreak is Dr. Seema Yasmin. She is public health professor at the University of Texas at Dallas and a staff writer at the Dallas Morning News. Her recent reporting on the Zika virus can be found online at dallasnews.com. She also wrote an article for the Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. Seema, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me again.
So the WHO has declared Zika a public health emergency. What does that designation mean?
It really focuses political attention on this issue. Also, declaring it a public health emergency of international concern helps mobilize money. And it tells the international community that this is top priority now on the public health agenda. And it's interesting they did this because they haven't done it very often. It's happened about three times before, once in 2009 for H1N1 pandemic flu. It's happened for polio in 2014. And then, of course, for Ebola. That was the last time we heard about this kind of emergency declaration.
So it's an emergency declaration of a virus that has been known to medical science for decades. Why is it suddenly a global concern?
I'm so glad you picked that up because some people keep talking about it as being new. And okay, it's new in the Western Hemisphere, but it's not new per se. We discovered Zika in 1947 in the Zika forest in Uganda, which is where it gets its name from. And ever since then, we've documented outbreaks of Zika virus in parts of Africa and Southeast Asia and Micronesia, the Pacific Islands. So it's not like we'd never heard of it. It's not like we didn't know it could cause these kinds of outbreaks. But the reason it's concerning now is because, one, it's arrived somewhere new, the Western Hemisphere, Latin America, the Caribbean, and two, because it's spreading really quickly. And of course, that third reason, which remains to be proven, but is this very strongly suspected link between Zika virus and babies being born with a serious birth defect called microcephaly.
All right, I want to talk about that. We'll explain what microcephaly is first so that people have a handle on this. This is infants born with brain deformities, skull deformities, and they are deeply cognitively challenged.
They can be. Actually, 15% of babies born with microcephaly can have what we'd consider to be normal intelligence. So it really varies. It's a whole spectrum from mild microcephaly to severe microcephaly. So the word itself just comes from the Greek words for small head. And we can measure it either when a woman is pregnant by digitally doing an ultrasound scan and measuring the fetus's head. And then you can measure it when the baby is born as well. But they can seem to be normal at birth and develop it in the first year or first few years of life as well. And there's so much interesting discussion and debate and even arguments right now in the scientific community about this and the potential link to Zika virus. Because on Monday, yesterday, when the World Health Organization declared this a public health emergency, check out the wording, because it wasn't specifically Zika virus. It's really this cluster and this potential increase in babies being born with microcephaly that could be linked to Zika virus, which is the really concerning thing. So it remains to be proven. We haven't got scientific evidence that one causes the other. And we have to bear in mind that many, many things can cause microcephaly.
So what we know is that there's been a spike of cases in Brazil, and Brazil happens to be the epicenter of this Western Hemisphere existence of the Zika virus.
That's correct. And I'm an epidemiologist, so I'm very skeptical about data by nature, and I love it when I meet other journalists who are also skeptical about data. And there was a great reporter, I think his name is Will Carlos at the Global Post, who reported on this on the radio the other day. And he said he called Brazilian officials and he said to them, so how many cases of Zika virus have you had since last May? And they said, we don't know. And he said, wait, No, I'm reading everywhere that it said you've had between 500,000 and 1.5 million cases of Zika virus infections. And the guy said, OK, wait a second. And he came back on the phone and said, yep, that's what we're telling reporters. So we have to be aware that, yes, I think the World Health Organization did the right thing by calling this a public health emergency, because there's an epidemic, something is going on, but we don't know so much about the exact data. And so the way that that reflects on microcephaly is we've been hearing in Brazil that since last May, they've had about 4,000 cases of microcephaly. The debate in the scientific community is, one, is that really the number of cases of microcephaly? Because it's so rare. Normally in Brazil, you'd see about 150 cases a year. So people are questioning whether the diagnosis is correct. And then, of course, the second thing they're saying is, well, even if that is how many babies have been born with microcephaly, how can we be sure it's not due to the other things that cause it, like when the mother drinks a lot during pregnancy and has alcoholism, or if she's been smoking, or other infections like rubella and herpes and syphilis and cytomegalovirus. So all these other things that can cause it. So yes, it's a public health emergency, but we need to be aware that the data on this is really sketchy.
So what would it take to demonstrate a definite link between these two things?
It would take lots of scientific studies, and it would take time and resources, and we're so far behind on this. One of the interesting things people keep saying is, oh, this is what's scary because it's new. No one knew that Zika virus might be linked to any kind of neurological issue with babies, or there's another nerve damage issue it's causing as well, which we can talk about in a second. But actually, if you look back a year or two ago, there was an outbreak on some islands where, in hindsight, there were babies born with microcephaly during that time. About 12 babies, in fact, were born. And again, we don't know whether that was directly linked to the Zika virus, but it shows that, hey, at least there was the time thing going on. The Zika virus happening on the one hand, and then on this island, they also saw an increase in microcephaly at that same time. The same thing potentially happening in Brazil. And it's unfortunate that we're so far behind that now everyone's scrambling. Everyone who wants to travel is saying, well, is it okay if I'm in my first trimester? Is it okay if I'm not pregnant, but I'm thinking of getting pregnant? And we can't answer their questions because we've neglected to do enough research on this.
What about Uganda, where the virus was discovered for the first time in 1947? Has it been known over time to have a higher than average rate of microcephaly?
In those countries, I don't know. And actually, when it was discovered in 1947, it was discovered in the blood of a rhesus monkey. And of course, there have been outbreaks in Africa since then. But really, when I looked in the literature to see if there was any kind of reporting on birth defects at the same time as the Zika virus outbreak, it was that outbreak that happened a couple of years ago in the Pacific Islands.
All right, let's step back for a minute. If I went somewhere that the Zika virus was present and I were bitten by a mosquito, would I definitely get sick?
Not necessarily. And what we know is that even if five people get the infection, four of them won't even know they have it. They won't have any symptoms. That one person in five who does get the infection, they'll in fact have quite mild symptoms. And they'll have a rash, fever potentially, headaches, red eyes and joint pains. And all of those things go away on their own in a few days. They probably don't even last a week. So people may or may not even realize that they're sick with something. And that's concerning because now we're going back to that whole pregnancy travel advice issue. The CDC is saying to pregnant women, if you have already been somewhere where there's a Zika virus outbreak, then you come back home to the US. If you have symptoms of Zika virus, talk to your doctor, talk to your midwife, they can test you. Well, that's at odds with the idea that four of five pregnant women who may have been infected on vacation or wherever won't have any symptoms. So why aren't we testing them as well?
When we are tested, assuming that someone has had the infection, whether they felt sick or not, and recovered from it, I guess you wouldn't have to recover if you never felt sick, are you then immune to reinfection?
Potentially, yeah. And we think that that might be the reason why this outbreak is so bad right now, because it's the first time we're seeing this infection in the Western Hemisphere. So no one here has built up an immunity to it. And that's why the other outbreaks we've seen in parts of Africa and Asia and Pacific Islands and Micronesia, there have been outbreaks there before. So if there's an outbreak there again, it's not as big as this one because people have had that exposure. Their body and their immune systems had a chance to build up immunity to it.
I know you're not an entomologist, but any thoughts on how a virus that is carried by mosquitoes in Africa would get to Latin America?
Because we already have those mosquitoes here. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple of theories about how it got to Brazil, which are really interesting and haven't been proven, but they're fascinating hypotheses. One is that it got here during the World Cup. and that there were people that travelled from regions where this virus circulates and they had the virus in their bloodstream, arrived in Brazil and got bitten by the local mosquitoes, and that's how the virus became established in that region. The other theory is that in 2014, there was a boating competition, a canoe competition in Rio de Janeiro, and people who were competing in that competition came from islands where there have very recently been outbreaks of Zika virus. So it's not surprising, though, is it? Because of globalization, because of how much we travel, you know, we live in what we call a global village. An infection in one part of the world eventually is going to end up here.
The mosquitoes associated with Zika virus are nasty little son of a guns. You describe them as aggressive biters.
I hate them. I hate them so much. And you remember growing up with the advice, at least I remember growing up with the advice, that when you travel somewhere exotic and it has malaria, avoid the mosquitoes from dusk till dawn. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you could be sunbathing all throughout the day, having a glorious time, and then you cover up in the evening when it gets cooler anyway. Well, not with these ones. The mosquitoes that spread Zika are the Aedes species, mainly Aedes aegypti, and they love us so much that they don't really bite that many other animals. They love humans, and all the textbooks call them aggressive bites. So I didn't come up with that. But the annoying thing about them is they like to bite us during the daytime as well. So which means you have to wear loads of insect repellent and you have to cover up during the daylight hours when it can be really hot outside and you may not want to cover up. They also like us so much that where other mosquitoes will be, maybe around the home but further away on the perimeter of the home, Aedes aegypti will be close, really close to the outside of the house and even inside with us. And that's where this advice comes about cranking up the air conditioning, keeping the windows closed and making sure that you have window screens. But because they like to bite us during the day, it means we have to make sure people realize that they're not like the other mosquitoes that bite at dusk and dawn. And it means things like bed nets don't work because they're not biting us when we're sleeping.
And, you know, saying crank up the air conditioning, close the windows is all well and good if you have windows and air conditioning. But lots of people in the developing parts of Latin America in particular don't have those things.
Absolutely. So we're talking now about educating people in parts of Latin America and the Caribbean, telling them how to, you know, wear repellent and crank up the air conditioning. But how is that feasible advice if you live in poverty, if you live in a shack, if you don't have secure housing and it's completely open, you may or may not even have windows. So it's not very practical advice.
What about repellents? There are people who, you know, swear by them. There are other people who would prefer not to put chemicals on their bodies and just sort of distrust anything that has a chemical name.
Yeah, that's understandable, and especially when somebody is pregnant, because you know what pregnant women are like? They're so careful about what they put in their body and on their body. But you need to make sure that to avoid getting bitten by these mosquitoes, you wear an insect repellent that has DEET in it, or you can check on the CDC website because they do list ones that are more natural, so they contain lemon oil or eucalyptus oil in them. You can check on cdc.gov to make sure that you are wearing the right kind of one. But there are ones that are very, well, I would say chemically, you know, but they're known to work, and there are more natural ones that also work, but make sure that you do use one that does its job.
So Aedes aegypti are known to live in Texas?
They absolutely are. And in fact, by some scientists' estimates, they cover 60% of the U.S. And about 22.7 million Americans live in parts of America where it's humid most of the year and, you know, it's pretty warm year round, and where those exact mosquitoes that can spread Zika will also thrive year round. And here in Texas, you know, it's already warming up, and it only has to be about 60 degrees Fahrenheit for these mosquitoes to be active and to start biting us.
That's the downside of a mild winter, certainly, that we haven't had. And we haven't had that kind of freeze that some people think might kill off some mosquito larvae over the winter.
We haven't had that. And even if we had had that, as soon as it starts warming up, they're back in action anyway. So it has to be relatively mild for them to be around and to be biting us. And it's really important to remember that it takes such a small amount of water for them to breed in. I've heard scientists say that they've seen Aedes aegypti mosquitoes breeding in discarded soda caps. Like, that small amount of water is sufficient for them to breed.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Seema Yasmin, public health professor at the University of Texas at Dallas and staff writer at the Dallas Morning News. Her reporting on the Zika virus can be found online at dallasnews.com. If you've got a question about this, you can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
The World Health Organization is declaring an international emergency in the number of countries that stand to be affected by the Zika virus.
The situation meets the conditions for a public health emergency of international concern.
Zika may be responsible for thousands of birth defects.
Last week, the first U.S. case of a baby infected in the womb was reported in Hawaii.
Zika is forcing families to make heart-wrenching decisions about whether to have children.
Some of the reporting that has been done on the spread of the Zika virus now through Latin America. We are speaking this hour with public health professor at the University of Texas at Dallas, Dr. Seema Yasmin. She's also a staff writer at the Dallas Morning News, and you can find her reporting online at dallasnews.com. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Seema, there are a number of countries now, it started with El Salvador, that are saying to women, avoid pregnancy until more information is available about the Zika virus or until it's under control. This might sound simple if you're not living in one of those countries and you're not a woman of childbearing age, but it's a complicated and pretty onerous restriction.
It is, and it has moral implications too. So the public health recommendations in some of these countries, including some that even haven't even had any transmission of Zika virus locally, is to delay pregnancy until the outbreak is over. In the case of El Salvador, they've even said wait until 2018, which I'm not sure how they came up with that particular date. The problem is that in many of the countries in Latin America that have given this pregnancy advice, they're assuming that women are empowered enough to have control over their reproductive health. They're assuming that women are able to make those kinds of decisions and have the resources at hand to do so. But the reality is that in some of these countries, more than 50% of pregnancies are unplanned. So then how do you delay a pregnancy anyway? And also women have considerable hurdles in getting access to contraception, family planning care, and to pregnancy termination. In fact, it's illegal in El Salvador to have an abortion. But at the same time, you're telling women that they may or may not have babies who might be born with a very serious birth defect. So one of the things that's very frustrating is, yes, yesterday the World Health Organization declared this a public health emergency of international concern. So they kind of rang the alarm bell and then didn't do much beyond that. They didn't stand up for women's reproductive rights. They didn't say in order for women to be safeguarded, in order for this epidemic to be diverted and perhaps not affect as many children as it might do, women need access to good family planning. Women need to be empowered. They didn't say anything like that.
Why not?
I don't know, actually. And I think it comes back to, well, we've had so much criticism of this agency since Ebola. They were late to that game. They're late here again. I'm not sure, actually, why they were not brave enough to stand up for something so straightforward. But having said that, I mean, like I said, they rang the alarm and then nothing much more came with that. They didn't offer any travel advice, which was interesting. They just said there would be no travel restrictions and no travel bans. But by doing that, there are odds with the CDC even, who is saying to pregnant women, hey, if you're going to travel to these countries, delay it until the outbreaks are over, or at least until we know more. But they didn't do, the World Health Organization didn't say anything about travel. It didn't say anything about how they were going to mobilize resources. It didn't say anything about how they were going to make sure the response to this epidemic was coordinated.
Assuming that there is, in fact, a direct link between the Zika virus and microcephaly, and as you've stated before, this is an assumption, but it's not been proven. It's a possibility. What would a virus that is so mild in a healthy adult woman, how might that affect the development of a baby in utero?
Well, we are finding now that it looks like it can be found in the placenta, so it does cross that barrier between the mum and the baby and has some kind of impact on the baby's, it could have impact on the baby's nervous system and how it develops. But we're also seeing that it can impact adults too. You may have heard reports of a spike in a disease called Guillain-Barré syndrome in parts of Brazil, particularly in northern Brazil. This is a really rare syndrome that can occur after you've had an infection. In the US, we sometimes see it very rarely after someone's had food poisoning. And what happens is the body overreacts to the infection and it kind of goes overboard. And so the immune system, instead of just attacking what it needs to attack, it starts attacking the body's own nervous system. And so that might be what's going on here. We really will need to find out more because we know that other infections also can cause microcephaly. There's rubella, there's herpes, cytomegalovirus, syphilis, all of them in different ways impact the way the nervous system develops in the unborn child.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Katie on the line in Dallas. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Chris.
Go right ahead.
I was wondering if there were any risks known possibly to young children whose brains were still developing, you know, who had already been born.
We haven't heard reports of that, but that's a really good question because microcephaly isn't just something that you can diagnose when a woman is pregnant on her unborn child. It's something that can develop in the first few years of life as well if children are exposed to certain infections or even if they have brain injury. So it's something that we'll need to look out for. I haven't seen any reports of that in the literature. The only link that I saw was in this recent outbreak in Pacific Islands where there had been 12 babies born with microcephaly. So it remains to be seen whether it's also a risk to young children, but it might well be.
Brazil is supposed to be hosting Summer Olympics this next summer. What are your thoughts on the amount of caution with regard to travel and whether we're overreacting, underreacting? You said that the World Health Organization didn't want to enact any travel bans. A lot of countries are saying maybe you shouldn't go. There are economic implications. Ironically, you know, for the same people who might be too poor to be able to resist this infection, an economic boost from something like the Olympics might be helpful.
Huge economic implications. In fact, not even just with travel bans, that anytime the World Health Organization declares a public health emergency of international concern, you can bet that that region that's affected will see a massive decline in their GDP. It happened in West Africa with the Ebola epidemic. When that was declared a public health emergency, Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone saw a decrease in investments and revenue of about $1.5 billion at that time. So big implications. I don't think it's an overreaction, though. I think especially for pregnant women, it's fair to say, look, even though it's not proven that Zika virus may cause microcephaly, we think there could be a link. I think it's fair to say to pregnant women, until we find out more, it's best that you don't travel to those areas. And it's not just the Rio Olympics. I mean, that will happen when it's hopefully cooler and drier in Brazil. But right now in the rainy season, we're coming up to Carnival, which people from all over the region will travel to, all over the world, in fact. We're already hearing that some cities are cancelling those festivities and others are actually using it in a really interesting way to promote education and awareness about Zika virus and about mosquitoes. So there's been people doing samba dancing dressed up as mosquitoes to raise awareness. But it's not just the Rio Olympics, it's Carnival that's a concern as well.
Why are mosquitoes so hard to control?
Gosh, I hate mosquitoes with a passion. They
cause so much misery.
So much. I was thinking about half the world's population is at risk of malaria, a disease that's spread by mosquitoes. And in fact, malaria kills like 500,000 people every year and thousands of children. We have to bear in mind that there are about 3,500 different species of mosquitoes. Only a handful of those actually cause infections in humans. So the vast majority don't bite us, or at least they don't spread anything nasty to us. But mosquitoes are really hard to control. So even now in Brazil, in some cities, they are fumigating and they're sending people around with insecticides and pesticides to spray areas. That's great, but then people might live very close to the Amazon rainforest, for example, or swamplands. How do you control mosquitoes in that area? I mean, that's their natural habitat, so it's very concerning. If we look at history, it has been done before, but it's taken huge efforts. In the 1930s, there was an American doctor called Dr. Fred Soper, who managed to get rid of a malaria-causing mosquito in parts of Brazil. But he was known as a fanatic. And in fact, he said that getting rid of mosquitoes was impossible under a democracy. Because under him, the way that he did it was he worked with the Brazilian government. And at that time, it was illegal to forbid entry to a mosquito inspector into the home. So those are the kinds of measures you'd need to try and actually get a handle on this problem. And you can imagine how difficult that can be.
Presuming that there is the technology available to eliminate or stop the reproduction of the mosquitoes that are associated with the Zika virus, are there any long-term consequences to the ecosystem of taking these insects out of commission?
We don't know, but ecologists are ringing alarm bells as well and saying, look, of course there's going to be downstream consequences of this, even though they cause human disease. If you get rid of mosquitoes, you might eliminate many species that are valuable to us that feed on them. I think I would weigh on the side of, can we just get rid of them because they are cause so much death and so much illness, but we have to kind of weigh that, well, what kind of other implications might there be? And the technology is, we're starting to see it. We're seeing Oxitec, which is a genetically modified mosquito, the male mosquito of Aedes aegypti, which spreads not just Zika, but also dengue, chikungunya, and yellow fever in some parts of the world as well. With the Oxitec technology, this genetically modified male mosquito will go out and mate with the female mosquitoes, the ones that bite us, but the offspring that they give birth to won't survive to adulthood. So we're seeing these kinds of technologies, and people who are in defense of them will say, well, it may not have a massive ecological impact because we're targeting specific species, the ones that cause harm to humans. But even then, other biologists are saying we need to be very careful.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Carrie in Arlington. Hi, Carrie.
Yes. Dr. Yasmin, you described two scenarios for the outbreak of the dengue virus. And just now, maybe you're touching on the third that I would like to hear more about. The account that I read, this third scenario, described scientists in western Brazil doing genetic tests on a mosquito. Maybe it's your Oxitec mosquito. And this mosquito got loose and became this virulent carrier of the Zika virus when it was intended to suppress the dengue fever.
Do you know anything about that?
I've heard about that, but I don't know if it's been substantiated by scientists or where those reports are coming from. So I'd be careful about commenting on that. But one of the things that Oxitec have said is that it is the male mosquitoes that are genetically modified. And those are the ones that feed on nectar. They don't feed on us. It's the female ones of most mosquito species that will take a blood meal from humans or from other animals. And of course, there are going to be concerns with any genetically modified organism as to what kind of impact that could have on wild-type mosquitoes. But we know that Oxitec is pretty effective because when they have trialed it in parts of Brazil, it's reduced the population, the mosquito population, by between 82 and 90%. So we'll have to weigh that success with the impact on ecology and also any downsides of genetically modified organisms.
What's involved with the effort to come up with something like a vaccine?
We are just so far behind on that because we've neglected this virus for so long. The scientists that I've spoken to have said it will take about 10 years. Some say 15 years. The one thing that might stand to benefit us is that we've done some research for vaccines on things like West Nile and also dengue fever. And they're kind of related to Zika virus. They're not exactly the same. But our research on those other viruses could stand as a kind of like a jumping board to working on a Zika virus vaccine. But it would have been so helpful to have that now already.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Greg in Dallas. Hi, Greg.
Hi. It's a great show so far. I'm glad that you mentioned the Oxitec male mosquito because that's exactly what my call was about. And they say after the second release of those, they were able to get the populations of those disease-carrying specific species down to like 96% reduction after the second release of the altered males. So I was just going to speak in support of that because I don't like West Nile. And if it's only maybe 10 or 20 species out of 1,000, you know, there's a risk for systemic biological collapse because the frogs eat the mosquitoes and the birds eat the frogs and the snakes eat the frogs and the leopards eat the snakes and all of a sudden you kill all the mosquitoes and you don't have leopards. But wouldn't that niche be filled with another mosquito maybe? And I think that that technology to eradicate these few troubled species is really, I mean, I wish I could remember the podcast I listened to, but it was some like a radio lab or something like that where they cited their chikungunya or dengue fever fighting efforts were really mind-blowing.
Yeah, I mean, the figures speak for themselves with Oxitec, with the reduction of like 82, 90, 96% in the mosquito population. The issue, though, as well as what impact might this have on the ecosystem, is scaling up. Okay, this technology is there, but we need it in so many parts of the world right now, and we don't necessarily have a way of scaling it up so that it could be implemented everywhere.
What about spraying? Will that work in the short term?
It can do, and it's one way that we have used to get rid of mosquitoes before. But bearing in mind that Aedes aegypti really stick to our houses and even come indoors with us, which makes it less successful to spray from the street and spray from the air, according to the entomologists that I've spoken to. They've said in this instance, you really need to even get inside people's homes. And some of them, interestingly, have spoken up in favor of DDT. Remember that one? I mean, that was outlawed by the EPA in the US in 1972 because it's known to be so toxic to other animals. animals. But some people are now saying, look, this is getting so out of hand that we're not advocating for widespread use of DDT, but we are advocating for people being able to dab it on the walls in their house to get rid of it in those small areas.
All right, we're talking about mosquito-borne transmission right now, but there is evidence that the virus can be present in the sperm of men who've been infected.
Very, very little evidence, yep. There was a case report in a journal called Emerging Infectious Diseases of an entomologist who went to Senegal and became infected with Zika virus, then came home to the US and unwittingly passed it on to his wife, who then got Zika virus and became sick too, and they both recovered. But another researcher took blood samples and took semen samples and found the virus there. So potentially it can be transmitted sexually, but right now we think that the outbreak is really being fueled by the mosquito problem.
So if you know someone who is ill with Zika after traveling or whatever, there's not a real concern about spending time with them, that sort of thing.
We haven't heard that from any public health officials, but I mean, the evidence there, even though it's one person in the literature, the evidence is there that it can potentially be transmitted sexually and also through blood transfusions. There isn't a lot of data on that. And also to bear in mind that when you have Zika virus, it stays in your bloodstream for not that long, maybe a few weeks at the most. But already in Canada, I think last Thursday, Canadian officials said that anyone who's been to a country where Zika virus is endemic will not be allowed to donate blood for a while. And the FDA here said that they are reviewing their policies. They haven't spoken outright to ban blood transfusions or ban blood donations from someone who's been to a Zika area, but they're looking into it as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Sharon who wants to know what stage of pregnancy might the Zika virus be most dangerous?
We don't know. And people are speculating that could it be the first trimester? Because that's when obviously there's a lot of growth happening. But actually that may not turn out to be true, because with congenital infections, timing is everything. And different infections are more dangerous at different times of the pregnancy. With Zika, we just don't know.
So it's not possible to say after X weeks, you're probably...
We can't say that. We can't say that right now. And that's why the advice is to pregnant women that if you're pregnant in any trimester of pregnancy, you should avoid going somewhere with a Zika virus outbreak, because we can't say for now, oh, it's okay if you're in your first trimester, or it's okay if you're in your third. We just don't know.
We're speaking with Dr. Seema Yasmin. She's public health professor at the University of Texas at Dallas and a staff writer at the Dallas Morning News. You can read her extensive reporting on the Zika virus outbreak online at dallasnews.com. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about the Zika virus with Dr. Seema Yasmin, who teaches at the University of Texas at Dallas and writes for the Dallas Morning News. She's an epidemiologist. You can read her reporting on the Zika virus at dallasnews.com. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can also call 1-800-933-5372. Catherine in Highland Village wants to know, if someone has the Zika virus, should they be worried about getting pregnant and having babies with birth defects in the future after a year or more?
If you read between the lines of the CDC's travel advisory, then I'd say yes, because first off, they were saying that if you're pregnant, you shouldn't travel anywhere where there's a Zika virus outbreak. But now they're saying if you're thinking of traveling If you're thinking of getting pregnant, sorry, and you're going to travel to one of those areas, speak to your healthcare provider first. And there's huge ethical implications to this, especially in places like Brazil. Imagine if in 9 months' time we realize there really is a link and then we see this whole epidemic of babies born with microcephaly. I mean, that's just unconscionable. It's so scary to think about. But the advice right now is even if you are thinking of getting pregnant and you're going to go to one of these places, talk to your healthcare provider beforehand, just because we don't know much about this virus.
Of course, reading between the lines is challenging because sometimes they say, if you're thinking about getting pregnant, don't do this because you might already be pregnant and not realize it yet.
Absolutely.
It might mean you're trying.
Yeah, especially in the first trimester. I mean, it can be a few weeks before somebody actually realizes that they are pregnant. So that might be why the advice is there. But definitely, it's at odds with what the World Health Organization is saying, because when they declared this an emergency yesterday, they didn't really say anything about pregnant women and travel. So it wasn't the most helpful emergency alert because it didn't give us much information or much direction as to what we should be doing. But the CDC advice is, even if you're thinking of getting pregnant, talk to your healthcare provider first.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Ron on the line now in Dallas. Hello, Ron.
Hi, big fan of Dr. Yasmin. I've got a public health question. We're talking about the Zika virus because of the clustering of incidences of microcephaly in Brazil and stuff. My question is, prior to this current situation, is the doctor aware of clustering of microcephalia anywhere else in the world, or is it just a condition that's sort of randomly distributed across the human population?
Thanks for your call.
Microcephaly in general is a birth defect that can occur. I mean, it happens very rarely in the U.S. We see 2 to 12 babies born for every 10,000 live births. If your question is more specifically about whether we've seen it in relation to Zika, then the answer is yes, but I've only ever seen it in one journal article from an outbreak that occurred on Pacific Islands a couple of years ago, I think 2014. And in that article, they said that the Zika virus outbreak happened at the same time about 12 babies were born with microcephaly. Now, they couldn't say conclusively that the outbreak and the infection caused those babies to be born with a birth defect, but that is one instance where it's been reported that the two happened at the same time.
Has there ever been a situation when public health authorities advised an entire population of women to delay pregnancy?
You know, I'm sure there have been, and I just can't think of when there might have been. I'd be interested if any of our callers are aware, but I imagine that that has happened, and it's fine to give that advice to women, especially if you're really concerned about a very serious birth defect. But if you're going to do that, you have to make sure women have access to good family planning. It has to be practical for them to be able to access contraception and information and even resources to end pregnancy if they should so choose. And we're not seeing that in these countries where this advice is just being doled out. Hey, wait until 2018 to get pregnant. Well, that isn't practical advice in some of these countries.
I don't want to minimize the risk at all to the extent that we believe there is one to the infants of pregnant women who get infected with the Zika virus. But do we know that every pregnant woman who contracted the Zika virus has a baby with birth defects?
Oh, gosh, no, we don't know that at all. And in fact, as I was saying earlier on, lots of scientists are questioning this data about the microcephaly. Brazil said that about 4,000 babies have been born with microcephaly since last May. In one camp, some doctors are saying, well, are those actually microcephaly cases? Because there's a way to diagnose it and it can be tricky. And the report came back that about 300 have been confirmed as medically having microcephaly. So that leaves a few thousand or more where we don't know whether that is actually confirmed microcephaly. Of those about 300 that have been confirmed as having microcephaly, only 6 were said to have Zika virus. So we're in the single digits in terms of saying the number of babies that had the infection and also were born with this birth defect. So there's a lot more work to be done in terms of getting that data and proving an association between the two things.
It's early since we just had the World Health Organization's declaration yesterday of a public health emergency. But are you aware of women in affected countries sort of standing up and demanding greater access to family planning services?
Some advocates are doing that for sure. In parts of Brazil, some doctors are speaking out as well and saying that it's not feasible to say that people should delay pregnancy when about half of the pregnancies in some regions are not planned in the first place. So yes, some people are certainly speaking out, but we need more advocacy and we need an organization like the World Health Organization, the World Public Health Agency, to speak out and say that women should have greater rights to their reproductive health. Women should have better access to family planning. And they didn't do that yesterday.
And by and large, across the world, when women do have access to family planning, they use it. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah. The data definitely shows that women are more empowered. They have healthier pregnancies if they choose to get pregnant in the first place. It's a win-win for everyone, for the whole society, when women have access to family planning and they are empowered to make decisions about their bodies.
All right, let's go back to the phones at 1-800-933-5372. We have Kevin on the line in Dallas. Hi, Kevin.
Yes, hello. I was wondering, while we're waiting for a vaccine, is it possible for women that have the means to get the Zika virus on purpose while they're abstinent, you know, a few months prior to attempting to get pregnant, with the concept that once they get pregnant, their antibodies will fight it and be shared with the fetus as well, and be a solution for until the vaccine is ready?
What does the science say about an idea like that?
That's a great idea, theoretically. The problem is we don't know how long those antibodies would last. So it would be a problem to say, hey, you can get infected now when you're young and you're not pregnant and build up immunity. But what if that immunity wears off in 6 months? What if your antibody levels that would protect you against Zika virus wear off in a few months or a year? And then it's pointless because you may get infected 2 years down the line. So we can't say that just yet because we need to know more about how the immune system handles this infection. And we don't have that data yet.
1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number. Let's go to Donnelly in Irving. Hi, Donnelly.
Hi. Sorry, it's Valerie.
Oh, Valerie. Hi.
I was wondering, I was diagnosed, well, I developed Guillain-Barré about 15 years ago.
I'm so sorry.
And that's okay. It was pretty intense, but I recouped from it all. But I was wondering if I was more at risk to develop it again if I was bitten by one of those Zika mosquitoes?
That's a great question. And I've heard scientists ask the same thing. And we don't know. Because one of the things that would be helpful is to say pregnant women shouldn't travel until we find out more about this birth defect in an association. And here are some other groups of people that should be wary about traveling. And we haven't got that far yet because we don't know who those high risk populations should be. So, for example, we know that there might be an association between Zika and Guillain-Barré syndrome, but we don't know if those who've had Guillain-Barré syndrome in the past are more at risk with this now. So it'd be great to have that. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating to be here and to have so many unanswered questions and to think we could have had answers to these if we'd invested more in the research and if we'd anticipated that this infection would wind up here, because it's inevitable that it would eventually. And here we are now. We're scrambling to get answers. So we can't answer that question about those who've previously had Guillain-Barré syndrome.
Seema, talk about how decisions are made in the research community about what to jump on, because certainly there are a number of, you know, infectious agents out in the world at any given time. Resources are limited. How do people decide, OK, I'm going to shift my focus and focus on something like Zika virus because it appears to be on the horizon? And how often do they guess wrong?
Sadly, the agenda, for the most part, gets set by funding. And this shifted about last week. The National Institutes of Health sent out a mass email to lots of scientists across the country and said, hey, we're mobilizing funding for more research on Zika, which is great. But now that means people will shift from one thing to another and we're playing catch up. It will be 10, maybe 15 years until we have a vaccine. So I'd say that sadly, a lot of times it's not the burden of disease that sets a priority. It's the people at the top who decide how much money gets spent on what. And malaria is a great example. I mean, thousands of kids die every single day from malaria. I'm not sure how we managed to live with that figure, but we haven't got a vaccine for malaria. Even our treatments for malaria are not that great anymore because the parasite's becoming resistant. It's a problem that affects about half the world's population, but they're poor people. And so that isn't a top priority for us, sadly. And so here we are. We don't have a malaria vaccine. And I think that is one example that kind of speaks for the whole way that the agenda gets set for research and for public health.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Gavin in Dallas. Hi, Gavin.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hey, I was wondering about the mosquito control and, you know, eradication that you had talked about earlier. A few years ago, I saw a TED Talk with a team that had developed a laser fence for mosquitoes, and it could literally, like, zap them right out of the air, and it was so sophisticated that it could even discriminate between male and female mosquitoes so that it could potentially leave some of the beneficial ones behind that handle pollination and are part of the food chain. And I have seen nothing about it since that original TED Talk. I was wondering if your guest had any information about that technology.
Thanks for your call.
That's so interesting. I've read about lots of different ways and lots of different new technology of getting rid of mosquitoes. I haven't heard about that one. So I wonder if it's disappeared into the ether, or if they're kind of developing, working more on that. I read about one where you can infect mosquitoes with a specific bacteria that makes them less prone to picking up viruses in the first place. And in fact, when they have offspring, they pass on the bacteria, so it kind of perpetuates, and you basically have, you still have mosquitoes, but you don't have so many virus-infected mosquitoes. So there's technology out there that's being developed. Some of it isn't ready, and even what is kind of ready to go doesn't have approval in the right country, so we need it right now, and scaling up is a massive issue.
Do these viruses benefit mosquitoes in some evolutionary sense? That what allows them to carry this without getting sick? How does that work?
I think in that way, mosquitoes might be a lot like bats, in that bats will carry viral hemorrhagic fevers, things like Ebola, without getting sick themselves, but they're great at spreading it onto us. So these viruses, and in the case of malaria, these parasites have found a vector, found a carrier for themselves that is so efficient at getting its job done. It's so efficient at passing on the parasite or the virus to us and to other animals. So they've just found a really crafty, really efficient way of passing on the infection all over the world.
Can babies born with microcephaly have a decent quality of life?
Yes, they can, but it depends. It depends on what range of microcephaly they have, because it can go from mild to severe. And most textbooks will tell you that about 15% of babies born with microcephaly can have normal intelligence. For the others, what they really need is intensive assessment, and then they need intensive support in the forms of lots of therapy, so speech therapy, learning therapies, for example. That stuff's expensive and it's intensive. And you can imagine the women who are most affected now in Brazil and other parts of the world, they're poor women. They don't have good access to care, and their babies are certainly, I can tell you, not going to have access to the kind of support that they would need.
As an epidemiologist, how likely do you think it is that the Zika virus will be spread within the continental United States by mosquitoes here?
Oh, it probably will. So far, we have about 36 Americans, I think, at the last count, who'd been to Latin America or the Caribbean and had brought the infection back. At least four of those are pregnant women. So that's concerning. And all it will take is for them to be in the Houston area or anywhere where we have these Aedes aegypti mosquitoes to get bitten while the virus is in their bloodstream, and it stays there for about a week after you get infected, for that local mosquito to then jump and then bite somebody else. And that's how we'll see a local outbreak. And we've seen the same with dengue fever, for example. We've seen that in South Texas a few times. We've had outbreaks here, and we've seen it the same with dengue and chikungunya in other parts of the continental U.S. as well. So we should expect to see small outbreaks, probably nothing like what we're seeing in Latin America or the Caribbean. But again, we need to be aware that it's going to be poorer communities in the continental U.S. who are at most risk. And we've had so much research demonstrating this with West Nile, for example. There have been researchers in Cleveland, researchers here, who found that with West Nile outbreaks in Texas and other parts of the U.S., if you're poor, your neighborhood is more likely to be infested with mosquitoes. You're more likely to get infected. And not just that, but with West Nile specifically, if you're poor, you're more likely to die from the infection.
Do you think that American public health officials are paying sufficient attention to this at this moment? Did the WHO warning make a difference?
I think so. And I think they already were on board from a few weeks ago, maybe even a few months ago, since Brazilian officials have been sounding the alarm themselves about this outbreak. We've all been watching it very closely, because we've also all been watching dengue and chikungunya spread over here as well. So I think people are on board, but it will remain to be seen whether we'll implement the measures that will protect especially people living in poverty in the southern United States, all over the U.S. We have really deep pockets of poverty where people don't realize that it almost looks like the developing world. And those are the areas where we could probably expect to see bigger outbreaks than in wealthier regions.
Dr. Seema Yasmin is public health professor at the University of Texas at Dallas and a staff writer for the Dallas Morning News. Her recent reporting on the Zika virus can be found online at dallasnews.com. Seema, I always learn something when you come. Thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.